This week on Making Contact.
Our cost estimate for the securing the Southwest border is approximately $8 million, and our time frame for that is in the FY 2013.
In 2006, the Bush administration's Secure Border Initiative outsourced the surveillance of all U.S. land borders to Boeing Integrated Defense Systems. It's the largest homeland security contract to date, $30 billion. If completed, the Southwest border will be the most high-tech border this side of the West Bank. On this edition, independent producer Joseph Ritchie visits Project 28, Boeing's security site, a 28-mile strip along the U.S.-Mexico border. And we talk to No One Is Illegal organizer Harjot Graywal about migration and international trade. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, battle ideas, and important information. The issues surrounding undocumented workers have split opinions virtually everywhere in the U.S., in the halls of Congress, state legislatures, the news media, and the court of public opinion. And it's no different on the front lines of the U.S.-Mexico border. And while immigrants are not the enemy, they are often made out to be. Independent producer Joe Ritchie takes us to Aravaca, Arizona, where the conflict over intrusive federal government surveillance is ramping up. Sam Fuqua is our narrator.
Whitetail and Inca doves greet the first rays of sun in the Sonoran Desert. By noon, warm-blooded animals find shade. The sun can bring ground temperatures to 118 degrees. At nightfall, remote stretches of this desert come alive with human activity. Border crossers, walkers, migrants, smugglers, and those who chase them. Boeing Integrated Defense Systems and the Department of Homeland Security deemed the Alto Valley as top priority for SBINet, the high-tech component of the Secure Border Initiative. United States Marine Supervisor Mitch Ellis manages the 118,000-acre Buenos Aires Wildlife Refuge in Alto Valley.
This area was chosen because it's one of the worst places along the border. We have one of the biggest problems with smuggling anywhere in the country.
Like other border park and refuge managers, Ellis does not support a physical wall.
The other issue that doesn't get talked about a lot are the environmental impacts. If you do seal up considerable areas with a pedestrian barrier, that impedes the movement of wildlife also. So if you're going to bisect an ecosystem through here, then hey, you're not going to get deer, antelope, some birds that like to fly low won't go through. Most will go over, but the primary impact is going to be on terrestrial wildlife, small mammals, the deer population, maybe even jaguar. I mean, they're not going to seal up these mountain ranges. Jaguars will move through the mountains primarily, but the ecological impacts aren't being talked about a whole lot.
Environmentalists worry that increased detection will bring more apprehensions and put more wear and tear on the landscape. Boeing has placed 3 M-Star watchtowers and ground radar systems in the wildlife refuge.
We've worked quite a bit with the Boeing contractors implementing the towers. So really, the jury's out. If they can gain operational control of specific areas with this package of surveillance, detection, and detention, then, you know, that's fine. Will it stop illegal immigration? No, it's not going to stop it. It's just going to go somewhere else. But because it's not practical to seal up 2,000 miles of international boundary. I mean, who is going to spend that much money to do something like that?
East of the wildlife refuge is the town of Aravaca, Arizona. Here, as part of Project 28, Boeing erected a watchtower, even though the town is 12 miles from the border. Townspeople are not happy about it.
So to me, it's more like a prison. You have fences and you have spotlights on you at all times. That's not what I came here for.
C. Hughes moved to Aravaca 27 years ago. Her son Alex is a 50-year-old pilot from Aravaca. He expresses a common view held by the locals.
We have a tower here that does not look at the border, but does not look into some of the more traveled washes where people are coming through. It looks into our town. It looks into my neighbor's yard. It looks into my yard. And that's an issue to me of civil rights. I know there are cameras on street corners, in intersections, but those are public places. My yard is not a public place.
Andrea Morandos is a mother who lives in Aravaca. She's concerned about profiling.
But like my son, he looks very Hispanic, and he's very young, and the profile shape fit, you know, the whole shot. So if he's standing at the payphone, or if they see him driving down the road in his old car, because that's all you're going to buy for a kid, you know, he probably was pulled over every other day on the way to school. So, you know, think about what they might do with a tower situation of like, okay, I'm looking out there, you're hiking. If he's hiking, they're probably going to stop him, but they're not going to stop me. Or they may run over and check him, or question him, or pull him aside. Because he looks the scenario. You know, he's 6'2", shaved head, Hispanic. Mm-hmm. You know? So, you know, and that was one of the concerns too, is who's going to control it, and how are they going to, like, profile and question some and not others.
The American Civil Liberties Union is researching the violation of the privacy rights of Aravaca residents.
And if we thought it'd do any good, it might work. But, you know, we tease them like, we see a lot, the people who live here see a lot of stuff. And you might even tell the authorities what you see, and they don't do anything. So we're like, you know, you don't need a tower. You have 600 people who live here who tell you, you know, what's going on. But you don't do anything, so what's the difference with a tower?
John Warren of Aravaca says the security project might be a misallocation of public funds.
I guess I question how much money we can spend on towers and manpower and checkpoints and border fencing and, you know, millions and billions of dollars, and would that money be better spent somewhere else and actually addressing the problem as opposed to chasing the symptom?
Paul Charlton served for 6 years as U.S. attorney for the state of Arizona. He and other Arizona law enforcement officials question the emphasis on border security at the expense of other vital areas in the legal system. Charlton recently told an audience of border reporters,
I think it's sexy for politicians to say we're going to do something about the border by putting more Border Patrol agents on the line. It's a little like building a great football team and only having a bunch of linemen and nobody playing in the backfield. You can have a great line, but if nobody's playing in the backfield, you're going to lose every single game.
Charlton's office was ranked 5th in the nation for immigrant prosecutions, and Charlton himself was one of the 9 U.S. attorneys purged by then-Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez.
It doesn't sound quite as appealing to your constituents to say what we really need are more pretrial services officers. What we really need are more probation officers. But you really need more pretrial services officers and probation officers and prosecutors. Otherwise, the system fails because the deterrent effect is lost. Once people realize that they can cross the border time after time because the criminal justice system that's supposed to pick up after the arrest isn't capable of following through, then that desired deterrent effect fails. Then when I was the U.S. attorney, I argued for those resources unsuccessfully.
David Gonzalez, the U.S. District Marshal in Tucson, is responsible for maintaining prisoners, getting them to court, and once they're sentenced, getting them into prison.
Now, this buildup, as Paul mentioned, and along with ICE and DEA and FBI and a lot of the other investigative agencies down there, is literally crippling the criminal the court system. Okay, there are so many cases going through the system now, and we cannot keep up with the amount of prisoners. Let me tell you, we don't have any bed space to put federal prisoners.
Here's where two of the world's largest private prison and security corporations come in. Corrections Corporation of America and Geo Group, formerly Wackenhut, provide transportation and detention services to millions of immigrant families each year. Robles Junction is north of an abandoned Minuteman command center. It's at the intersection of Arizona Highways 86 and 286, the Devil's Highway. 8 to 10 busloads of captured migrants roll out of here every day. Meanwhile, stockholders for CCA, Geo Group, and Boeing have earned 25% dividends since April 2006, at the start of the Bush administration's immigration emergency. Early in 2007, just as Project 28 began, the SBINet contract came under harsh scrutiny at congressional hearings led by Henry Waxman.
I'm also releasing a memorandum today with new information about the SBINet contract. My staff has been examining what steps the department is taking to oversee the multi-billion dollar contract with Boeing to secure our borders. And what we have learned is that there seems to be no task too important to be outsourced to private contractors. As of December, the Department of Homeland Security had hired a staff of 98 to oversee the new SBI contract. That may seem like a lot of progress until you ask who these overseers are. More than half are private contractors. Some of these contractors even work for companies that are business partners of Boeing, the company they are supposed to be overseeing. And from what we are now learning from the department, this may be just the tip of the iceberg. As Yogi Berra once said, this is like deja vu all over again.
Congressman Mark Souter tried to nail down the timeline and cost of the virtual fence from SBINet Director Greg Giddens.
Do you believe that the entire land border will be secure by December 2008?
No, sir.
Do you know what the cost to secure the entire land border would be?
Our cost estimate for the securing the southwest border is approximately $8 million, and our time frame for that is in the FY 2013.
You think it'll be $8 billion to secure all the southwest border?
Yes, sir.
You don't agree with the $30 billion estimates, or?
No, sir. For the southwest border, our current cost estimate based on independent government estimate is $8 billion. That includes the acquisition as well as some of the integrated logistics and sustainment support through the year 2013.
And the current program that Boeing has is for 6 years?
The current program that Boeing has is one-year contract for that's renewable for up to 6 years.
So presumably you think this is at least going to take 6 years and $8 billion?
Yes, sir, for the southwest border.
Massachusetts Democrat Stephen Lynch.
Prior to coming to Congress, I had an opportunity to work as an iron worker for about 20 years. I was educated. I got my associate's degree in welding engineering, worked at the General Dynamics Shipyard. So I probably know just about enough in this matter to be dangerous. I have read all the documents, the audits, and based on the audits and investigations conducted by GAO and the Inspector General, as well as thousands of pages of documents provided by the Department to this committee, DHS's oversight of Deepwater and SBINet is severely limited by the prime negotiator contracts that actually vest almost all of the authority over this program, the design, construction, operation, and quality control with the private contractors hired to do the work. The documents indicate that the government, DHS, has contracted out the oversight of contractors to contractors. That's the problem. And in the case of SBINet, for example, DHS's expenditure plan identifies 60 of the 98 personnel assigned to manage the contract program as private contractors. The last time I saw this type of model for managing a project was the Big Dig in Boston. This is exactly what they did. They fused the oversight function with the engineering and construction function. Everybody was in the same tent. Nobody was watching out for the owner, who in this case is the United States taxpayer. This is a terrible model. I see a lot of it. And generally what we see is when this model is in place, we see just colossal failures here and huge cost overruns. So I'm delighted that we're having this this hearing.
Congressman Henry Waxman.
Of course, the question is, if you have a southwest border, is that going to stop all illegal entry into this country? Because there are other parts of the country where people can come through. In the northern border, people often get off on airplanes and have a visa and then overstay their visas. And if there's such a tremendous magnet for people to come into the United States, they're going to be pretty creative. So after we spent $8 billion and we see that sealed off, see how far we are in solving the problem.
Townspeople of Arivaca have strong views about the watchtower placed in their town. Earlier this year, concerned citizens gathered near the tower to organize.
And everybody gets a chance to talk, and if you, we're going to talk about our concerns. We're going all the way around this circle to talk about our concerns. I don't care how long it takes.
Somewhere out here in these washes and on these little footpaths, the illegal aliens use our sensors. When those sensors go off, it sends a signal or something to the tower, and the Border Patrol get all excited. They think they've got some criminals. If we go out there and trip those sensors, every chance we get, on bicycles, on foot, in our cars, and they get enough of those false alarms, hopefully, this makes a lot of sense, that's why I don't have a lot of faith in the government thinking this way, hopefully they will see that it's just getting local Arivacans and it's not doing what it's supposed to do.
My concern about this tower is it is like just one more mechanism to push toward this illusion of security that ultimately like builds insecurity within our communities. Above all, like my concern is that Arivaca is a testing ground, the first of many. And so how the community here responds is of great importance.
And if we say, yeah, okay, this tower, it's sort of in our backyard, but whatever, the next one's going to be on your doorstep. The next one's going to be on every single stoplight and every single town we go through. The next one's going to be on every stop sign.
And I think it represents, you know, everything that's wrong with our government right now, where they're taking away our rights and our privacy, and in the meanwhile, you know, stuffing the pockets of some corporation that's not accountable to anybody. So.
Yeah, here, here.
We're not at war with Mexicans. We're not at war with Mexico. Mexico's our friend. And these workers are carrying the backs of the United States and Mexican economy, carrying the economies on their backs. And they're creating the wealth. You know, Mexico's our number two trade partner. They are a number two trade partner because of those remittances that Mexicans send back. The hypocrisy of this policy is beyond description.
SBINet, or the virtual fence contract, could be pulled from Boeing as early as mid-December if it cannot comply with Department of Homeland Security timelines. A 2008 rebid would suit the competition fine. Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Ericsson, and Raytheon have new fence proposals for the southwest border ready and waiting. For Joe Ritchie and Making Contact, I'm Sam Fuqua.
The Government Accountability Office reports that a border fence along the 2,000-mile southwest border will cost between $6 million a mile to under $1 million a mile in remote areas just to put it up. That's not including maintenance and operation costs. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. For more information or for a CD copy of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast from radioproject.org. Boeing Integrated Defense Systems was hired to not only provide surveillance for the U.S.-Mexico border, but also for the U.S.-Canadian border. And border security policies and economic trade agreements are often connected. In fact, in 2005, heads of state from the U.S., Canada, and Mexico signed the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, or SPP. Proponents of SPP say the agreement provides greater cooperation between the three countries on security and economic issues. But critics argue that SPP follows in the footsteps of NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement, lessening already lax restrictions on multinational corporations, further tightening borders, and compromising labor movements and environmental protection standards internationally. Making Contact's Puck Lowe speaks with Harjap Graywal, who joins us from Vancouver, Canada. Graywal works with No One Is Illegal, a collective that works with immigrants, refugees, and Indigenous communities for justice in migration and anti-colonial sovereignty issues.
So tell me how you think we should be talking about immigration.
Yeah, you know, many people have referred to this sort of apartheid system that's being created around the world. It basically allows for trade to flow freely between borders, and creates a militarization of the border for people and prevents people from crossing the border, which in turn creates this very, very exploitable class of labor. I mean, there's sort of two ways you can have the debate. One is actually looking at things like, you know, both the U.S. and Mexican border and the Canadian and U.S. border have been imposed on communities that have existed here much before colonization. And those borders are basically means by which families are divided by each other. You know, people that share a history and share a lifestyle are divided by each other and would gladly, you know, have free movement between their communities. But it's being policed by these states that were created in order to control, you know, the people on this continent and extract resources, promote business. To talk about border controls, I think it really is problematic to even view these border controls as having any legitimacy when we, you know, clearly question the legitimacy of these states. There's also the argument you can have with the mainstream rhetoric around, you know, what immigration controls should look like and why they exist. And in that vein, it's also important to challenge, you know, this sort of security culture that's been created in post 9/11, but it also has existed with other, you know, sort of wars on terror, war on drugs, that sort of stuff, and also challenging this idea of illegal immigration and illegals that exist within these borders. Without acknowledging the fact that, you know, if most of the quote-unquote illegals in these countries, if they were removed from the country or deported tomorrow, the economies of these countries would literally collapse. And ever since people wanted to do business in other parts of the world, what people might call neoliberalism, but even going back to, you know, older forms of imperialism or colonialism, they've been displacing communities that have existed living off of their land for thousands of years. And with that displacement, what's happening is that you're basically creating, you know, labor, like these people that have to sell their labor to actually earn, you know, money to buy food rather than growing their own food. The most obvious example for the context of North America is Mexico, in that after entering NAFTA, In the 1990s and in leading into today, there's been millions of people that have been displaced off their lands and not being able to sustain themselves. And then they become this pool of labor that can be used as a highly exploitable form of labor if they end up crossing a border, because by crossing a border, you have even less rights than you would have in a country where the amount you can make and the level of income is much lower, but you are considered a citizen of that country. And, you know, we're talking about in the context of North America, but if you look at, you know, migrant labor movements in Dubai, in South Korea, in, you know, all over Europe, I mean, this is sort of the new world order that a lot of the Western, so quote-unquote, democracies are trying to establish. So, yeah, I mean, just to go back to neoliberalism, that agenda is still being promoted. You know, Canada, for example, right now is negotiating free trade agreements with India and negotiating free trade agreements with Peru. And the people from these very countries continue to be deported because you don't want them to come here and have any sort of citizenship. Yet also, at the same time, they're promoting people from places like Mexico and India to come here on guest worker programs, whereby they actually have no means of obtaining citizenship. So it allows you to, you know, sort of create this, you know, 21st century slave trade where people can basically be brought for labor and sold basically like on market. You know, your wages are determined not by the Canadian state, but are determined by what the company wants to pay you. And it sort of becomes this situation of bondage when you come here and you, you know, have a very precarious, you know, status in the country. You're not really going to be, you know, speaking out against your employer. You're not going to be demanding many more rights in the workplace or anything like that. So, I mean, I think what's happening is that when we see agreements like the Security and Prosperity Agreement, we're seeing very concretely, like the campaigns like No One Is Legal have been arguing and trying to put forward that these two things, neoliberalism and immigration and the exploitation of labor, all these things sort of go hand in hand and work very closely with one another to create good business environments for the elite of the world. And with the SPP, we're seeing that clearly. The Security and Prosperity Agreement calls for increased border militarization, calls for increased flow of resources and finances, and at the same time tries to create things like guest worker programs.
So some of the opposition that is coming out of Arizona to this virtual fence centers mostly around the legal rights of U.S. citizens to enjoy privacy and the rights of property owners. In that framing, the problems of immigration policy is that U.S. citizens shouldn't have to be inconvenienced in the process of enforcing security. And in that discussion about U.S. militarization, I'm curious what you think about the focus on civil liberties.
I mean, I think looking at it that way isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a bad thing when you don't realize the connection between, you know, looking at the issues of surveillance around private property and civil liberties and how that's pretty much a blueprint for what's happening on a national level. I mean, you know, the U.S. right now is trying to protect its private property, its claim to a certain resource in a certain labor climate. And, you know, when we see increased security in our neighborhoods, when we see increased security in, you know, like ghettoized communities where, you know, you might have a neighboring suburb where there's police patrols to make sure that people from a particular neighborhood aren't spending too much time in another neighborhood. You know, when we saw the situation with Katrina and a lot of, you know, people from the black community were trying to leave flooded areas of the city and trying to basically cross a bridge into areas where a lot of wealthy, white folks lived and how they were being stopped into entering that area. And I think, you know, when we talk about the policing of our own society and civil liberties within our own society, I think it's important to recognize that those same models work internationally. And it's also important to recognize that, like, the racialization of people contributes to both. You know, like, when we talk about this immigration debate, we've realized that, that clearly, you know, the war on terror and this creating of the other with, talking about these illegal immigrants and like all the sort of hysteria in the U.S. media that's existed around it, it creates the climate for people to accept that, look, hey, listen, there's this other and all of this surveillance and everything is okay. And it's important for civil libertarians that when they're talking about this to also recognize that, you know, a lot of that is also done locally. I mean, you know, people of color are constantly criminalized and labeled in the media as sources of crime, and that legitimizes the surveillance that even goes on domestically. So, you know, some of the nuts and bolts are, if you only look at some of the nuts and bolts, you're really not looking at what I think the agenda is, and you're only looking at maybe, you know, improving circumstances for a few people in society, probably a lot of white people rather than racialized communities. And creating this climate where, you know, you might feel more comfortable because maybe there isn't a camera in your backyard. But if you don't challenge these sort of underlying reasons and these underlying assumptions that the state tries to create in terms of racialized people, people of color, and whether they're identified as illegals or criminals or terrorists, you know, if that isn't challenged, you're only really creating comfort for yourself but not society as a whole.
That was Making Contact's Puck Lowe speaking with No One Is Illegal organizer Harjep Graywal. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. This show was produced by Joe Ritchie, with research assistance provided by the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Special thanks to Cynthia Weber, Tim Butler at democraticwing.org, Sam Fuqua at KGNU Boulder, Denver, the folks at Corp Watch, and to Dan Turner, Ron Recker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast Crew. For a CD copy of program number 5107, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.